gentlemen. Hello, listeners. This is David Marsh. I'm very pleased to welcome you to the OMFIF podcast. I'm the chairman of OMFIF, and I'm talking today to Dmitry Tokarev, who's the chief executive and founder of a company called COPPA, which is very active in the digital asset and custody area. And COPPA is a pioneer in quite a number of different fields. I'm going to be talking you, Dmitry, through a number of areas connected with central bank digital currencies and other features. So we're going to go into the politics of all this, but also enter into some of the more technical details. First of all, Dmitry, why do you think that central banks are suddenly so interested in digital currencies?
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much, David, for having me on the podcast. There are several triggers, some of them political, some of them coming, more from the private sector. I think initially Libra played quite a big part of it because, there's a lot of debate going on about, Facebook and the influence that it has now, or when they announced their intentions to basically enter into business of money effectively. Central banks took notice and thought, well, hold on a second. This is a company with 2 billion users. And if they have all the freedom they want to do anything they want with money, that opens up a lot of doors. On top of that, stable coins, I think, were a considerable factor. Things such as USDT, USDC, those are tokens based predominantly, people use them on Ethereum blockchain, but those tokens are pegged one-to-one to US dollar. And it came to the point where USDT started being quoted on the streets of Hong Kong, and that and it keeps growing as well, like the amounts locked into those tokens.
You mentioned Hong Kong, Dmitry. Do you think that China, the growth of China, also the fact that people tend to think that China is quite far ahead in the CBDC area, do you think that's played a role also in exciting interest?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as soon as China was the first one that came out and said that we are going to launch digital yuan, and that basically created a lot of presumed fear of the unknown of what this could result into. And a lot of governments has then started looking into this, and which also, in my opinion, triggered a lot of regulators to look closer to digital assets and provide some clarity, because, it kind of goes hand in hand.
Well, we are going through a massive crisis at the moment. We have COVID-19, which is still stalking the earth. And a lot of people all over the world have gone over to cashless payments because there is some worry, not totally proven, that cash may be a carrier of the infection. Do you think that's played a role as well, Dmitry?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a factor for moving society towards cashless state. Definitely played a role. But, you can live theoretically in a cashless state without CBDCs, but it's kind of started bringing the point like, okay, well, if we get rid of cash altogether, in what form money should live? And, the digital asset form is definitely on the table there for discussion.
It's obviously, it's opened up a tremendously new area, hasn't it? As you say, you don't have to have digital currencies to go. But a lot of people like cash because they feel familiar with it. Also, it's anonymous, and a lot of people in systems which have been totalitarian all over the world, they feel that they like cash because it's something of a safeguard against political intervention. Do you think the CBDCs pose a threat to the legacy system, the existing financial system as we know it? Because a lot of people wouldn't like that if that was the case.
Well, yeah, of course, it does provide anonymity, but it doesn't provide you protection against the government or the regime that issued those notes. We've seen it in Venezuela, Zimbabwe, Russia. Ultimately, they still can control essentially what that money is worth. So from the legacy and existing financial systems, I think the system definitely evolving. And if you look in expectation, I don't see another route rather than digital assets for all financial assets to be based on, including money issued by the government.
This brings us on to the fundamental question about whether the central bank digital currencies are there simply to facilitate the cross-border remittances for banks, where they could be very, very useful indeed, or could the CBDCs open up a door to retail accounts as well? So that would affect every man, woman, and child on the planet, in theory. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are two ways. Like, you know, with any new technology, you can, one could say, for example, you can enable in countries where, for example, you can't easily open bank account, but you do have a mobile phone. And, you know, that mobile phone is capable of having a wallet installed in it. And that wallet does support a particular currency the central bank has issued. That definitely leaves a lot of room for accounts which could have never been opened before. Now people can have bank accounts, essentially, well, just to be able to make payments. But at the same time, you know, in my opinion, the introduction of CBDC in a more traditional world is going to look more similar to the situation, you know, when LinkedIn, for example, was introduced. It was thought to kill all the recruiters. But as a matter of fact, it enabled recruiters to basically do their jobs much better. So one concern is basically if people can be their own bank and have their own wallets, essentially, with their own currencies, like what happens to commercial banking. If commercial banks adapt fast, and they probably will have to, they could facilitate those wallets, they could be those providers of such technology and give people, essentially, access to tools needed.
But it is going to make a fundamental difference, isn't it, to the business model of some key banks, because after all, remittances, we're speaking about cross-border remittances, for example, they do contribute quite a large amount to the bottom line,
yep,
and payments in general. So you're saying, yep, to the banks, this could be complementary, but you better get used to it because it's going to change your business model.
Yeah, I think it's a massive opportunity for banks. If they adapt technology fast and if they're able to have the infrastructure internally in order to support that could be a massive competitive advantage over the others, you know, who won't be as fast or as proactive in the space.
So you're saying get in there early and learn about the system. Can you tell us now about some of the pitfalls? Because I'm sure there's huge advantages, but there's also a lot of pitfalls, whether they be political or to do with procedures or to do with technology. So tell us about some of the downside.
General project of creating a CBDC is somewhat of a bit of a nightmare, to be honest, if I would undertake it. But first of all, you need to decide whether on what blockchain is going to live, right? It's going to be private or is it going to be public? Is it going to be in the form of a smart contract with methods which you then define to ensure that essentially that smart contract, you know, can't be hacked? And how do you then also establish the processes of minting and burning? Is there an API access to the central bank ledger, essentially, which updates it and keeps it up to date, which is, you know, probably unnecessary, but I mean that's how currently it is structured. So you might as well sync up to systems. First part is creating essentially the currency. In the end of the day, it will be a token of some kind or a coin, essentially, either on its own blockchain or in a forked version of a blockchain or in the private blockchain. And those decisions need to be made by the governments or whoever's involved in creating their own CBDC, and which is difficult. It's a lot of decisions to be made, and we know, you know, it's very, very hard to pass those decisions through governmental organizational structure. So that's part of the problem, right? So the first part. Then you've got the second part is, like, once you've done all of those steps, what sorts of regulatory requirements are you going to attach to it, you know, in terms of, like, who can custodize it, how they can custodize it, what sort of reporting is needed towards it. In reality, the way it could be done, it could be a blessing in disguise for all parties involved because of the transparency of blockchain, of traceability. You can deregulate so many things, which are currently you kind of have to do because it's all centralized and all of these databases need to sync up with each other. If everything is transparent and whoever needs to know information has access to this information, they can basically fetch the data and you know, process it and have all the information available to them 24/7, 365 automatically.
And are you saying that to get the best out of the system, it's best to have some sort of public-private partnership? Because after all, the public sector hasn't got a monopoly of expertise and neither does the private sector. So is that the key to developing this and to try to avoid pitfalls to have a genuine public-private partnership?
I think it's unavoidable that when it comes to either central banks or most of the commercial banks, that they will have to work together and work with private companies like Copper in order to essentially figure all of this out. Because first part is creating CBDC. Then the second part is how to ensure that the infrastructure is there to support it. Because obviously things that are built in the 70s and still, you know, powering our financial system is just of no use for newly minted tokens that will be running. So I think it's definitely the case. Whereas if you're a central bank or if you're a commercial bank, you essentially, one needs to figure out how to create it and the other needs to figure out how to provide infrastructure for it.
Good. So that could be some interlocking nature between the two. Let's get into some of the technological questions. Now, first of all, blockchain and DLT technology, a lot is said about that. How essential are both of these to the development of CBDCs?
I would say it's quintessential. I mean, the general idea, I mean, maybe for a wider audience, why people are excited about blockchain, because, you know, we heard it like for the last 4 years, and, you know, so far it's been, you know, Bitcoins, few tokens here and there, et cetera. But the power of blockchain is that for the first time, we have fully decentralized, most secure database in the world. So anybody can basically fetch the data from the database. What it does in return is that all of the other databases, like right now in the centralized world, they don't need to sync up with each other. So for example, if I made a payment to you and we have two databases, one database basically needs to register that the payment received, another database needs to register that the payment basically, you know, has been sent, and all of that needs to make sense as a system. So with blockchain, there is no room for a mistake or, you know, double entry and things as such nature, because essentially it's one place. So we're all working in one place. So it's effectively, like, instead of sending Word document back and forth, we just work in a common Google Doc, which is always up to date.
Are you saying that this is also a good way of avoiding fraud?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it's for the first time you can be, instead of being reactive, you can detect things in real time, because you have a full BI information at all times on the panel through, you know, different signaling tools or monitoring tools that you can implement. It's quite powerful in terms of like what kind of things you can do with it once it's up and running. Getting it up and running is probably the hardest part.
To allow people to understand this a bit better, can you explain the difference between private and public keys?
On the blockchain, there are no such things as, you know, accounts. That concept doesn't exist, essentially. You can't create an account, quote unquote. What you do is you basically pick a pair of public and private keys, and all of them have been theoretically already been created. So it's like picking an atom in the universe or a grain of sand in, you know, 100,000 beaches. So the chances of you picking the same grain is basically 10 in the power of, I think, minus 25 or something like that. It's so low that it's basically mathematically impossible to do that. So once you pick that pair, one public key is your address, essentially. Think of it as your address of your house, for example. It's got postcode, it's got street name, and it's got apartment number. So anybody who knows that address can put an envelope with, you know, $10,000 through your letterbox. But only you with a private key essentially can unlock that door and collect the funds. So that's the difference between public and private key. So in a banking world, public key is more of a combination of like IBAN and SWIFT, and the private key is considered an unlimited access to your bank account, essentially. That's why fundamental questions like what happens to that private key, where does it store it, in what form does it store it, what do people do, it is essential, because whoever's got the private key controls your funds. So, which is, you know, a huge consideration if you're talking about giving access and assets to general public, and, you know, they'll lose private key, what happens then, you know. So.
And what about some of these new methods that are being used then to make the techniques somewhat more efficient? We talk about these things called zero-knowledge proofs and multi-party computation. Can you explain about these new technologies? How essential are they? They're all very new, so aren't there some problems that by implementing these new technologies, you're going to somehow upset the whole process because there's risks applied to these new methods?
It's a common misconception, actually. Like, it's new in crypto space, but it's not new in cryptography space. People just didn't really care about them that much before, you know, in need in custody came up a few years ago. But effectively, zero knowledge proof allows you to communicate any information in an unencrypted format in such a way that essentially you can publish it on your Facebook or in a newspaper, and it gives no sensitive information to any attacker. And multi-party computation is actually a very interesting technology, because remember we talked about that private key, so that is the vulnerability standpoint. MPC allows you not to have it. It basically creates you an address, public key, without creating a private key. So it's a door without basically a keyhole in it. So there's no key. So you create basically an address without any private keys. And when you sign transaction or you would like to collect the funds, you do it essentially through a MPC protocol in such a way that private key is never put together and it's never revealed. Therefore, vulnerability of private keys being stolen or misappropriated or sniffed disappears by default. So that's why this technology is super interesting.
And of course, these things are changing at absolutely stellar speed. So there's going to be lots of things changing also in coming years. What about the whole business about the key management practices? And why is it that there's been such an astronomic advance in this area?
Well, because of the institutionalization of the space, you know, so we're obviously talking here about, you know, CBDC and we're talking about commercial banks. But for the last 2 years, we've seen companies like high frequency trading houses, prop shops, OTC desks, market makers, funds of all sorts of nature, statistical arbitrage, market neutral arbitrage, long only funds, growing at an astonishing rate. And people who run those businesses on the buy side basically switch from traditional space. So question of custody became very, very important in late 2017. And that's essentially how the whole idea of what do we do with private keys and what's the correct way of managing our funds is when we're talking about, you know, not like, you know, one Bitcoin, but several thousand Bitcoins and with one client, it becomes very important essentially what happens to the funds, because the nature of those assets, especially if we're talking about crypto, you know, Bitcoins and similar, you know, the transactions are immutable. You can't reverse it. So once it's out, it's out. You can't bring it back.
With central banks now entering the market and getting really excited about this, and of course also hiring people from the private sector, do you think central banks, which are normally rather staid, do you think that they themselves are going to be adding further to the pace of technical advancement?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable, because I think, you know, when central banks are developing their own currencies, they will have to build in rules for essentially like things like minting and burning or being able to burn the tokens. Because, for example, if a customer or a client, or in the particular case, a citizen whom basically used a proof wallet, say, for example, then lost their seed phrase or lost their password, there should be a way for them to recover their funds by burning funds on that wallet and giving them either traditional cash or cash in a bank, or issuing them with new digital currency. So I presume those rules would have to be inbuilt into the protocol itself, depending upon, like, you know, which ones are running. Several ones of those already support such functionality. At the same time, some of them might look towards smart contracts and building coins in the form of smart contracts. So it's definitely going to help the development of the space.
Good. And then just final point, looking into the future, when we're trying to guess when a CBDC will actually be introduced, either in the wholesale area or in the retail area, or conceivably both. Could you look into the crystal ball, please, Dimitri, and tell us when you think such an innovation will actually be seeing the light of day, and where in the world do you think this is going to happen?
Well, China is the natural candidate to be the first there, because obviously they started the first and been announcing test projects already. But at the same time, what we're seeing right now is a dynamic where, first of all, regulators finally started making up their minds in terms of what are digital assets and how those digital assets need to be handled. You know, if you look at India, if you look at Russia, in those places, they either decriminalized or provided the clarity towards what are digital assets and how crypto assets can be handled. What that did in turn is that it provoked the banks, the commercial banks in those countries, to look into this closer and essentially say, well, look, if this is now legal, like not in a gray area, and not illegal, basically, like fully in a white zone, they essentially started looking at how do we enable our customers for crypto first. So I would presume some countries would look into CBDC first, whilst others would give it a go and seeing how it goes with crypto assets and seeing how commercial banks react and service crypto assets. By crypto assets, I mean, you know, Bitcoins, Ethereum, et cetera, et cetera. That seems like a natural step, just taking it slowly and ensuring that part works correctly. And that part would give them a lot of information which they can share, like a regulator can share with the central banks, and come up with a mutual solution of how those currencies should look like.
But just sticking with the countries for a moment, where do you think that leaves, say, the United States and Europe? And just talking about CBDCs here, not about crypto assets, at the moment, the US is quite a long way behind, but it could be that they'll make up that pace. Also, there's different developments in different parts of Europe and the UK, and the ECB clearly are going along parallel, but slightly different tracks. So could you just say a few words about the advanced countries, please, Dimitri?
Well, I think like 46 central banks, if I'm not mistaken, according to recent IMF working paper, basically have projects in CBDC, and several one of them announcing the pilot soon. But it's very, very hard to estimate which ones would be the first. But if, you know, gun to my head, I would say it would be China, basically. There is a bigger plan there, and, you know, especially it's a country with capital controls in place. And also probably the ones which are losing control the most, I would say, out of all the other countries because of the, you know, relationship between mainland and Hong Kong and USDT being quoted. It's never been easier, essentially, to move basically dollars between mainland and Hong Kong than it is now, due to the fact that you can simply buy into crypto in Hong Kong and move it to mainland and vice versa.
Well, that's a whole new area that I'm sure we'll be exploring in further conversations, what might be happening between mainland China and Hong Kong. But thank you. We'll hold you to your prognosis that China will be the first, and we'll see what happens there. So, Dimitri Tokarev, thank you very much indeed for talking to me, and I look forward to our next conversation to tell us where we're going further on the road towards CBDCs. So this is David Marsh signing off. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, David.